Friday, August the 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, could China's economic woes be turning around?
I think there's still a lot of negatives around China, and this could just be a short-term rebound unless we see convincing steps in coming days by the Chinese government.
Also ahead, Iran sees a lucrative future when tourists return, plus remembering the tragedies wrought by Hurricane Katrina. Everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Stock markets rallied around the world on Thursday after days of market turmoil driven by fears that China's economic growth was slowing. In a volatile trading session in New York, the S&P 500, the Dow Jones, and the Nasdaq all gained well over 2%. Key European indexes advanced more than 3%. Earlier in the day, Hong Kong gained 3.6%, Tokyo rose more than 1%, and the Shanghai stocks soared more than 5%. And even with some better numbers in China, IHS Global Insight Chief Economist Rajiv Biswas in Singapore tells VOA's Victor Beatty there's more to the Chinese economic story.
I think we've seen some confidence coming back into the Asian markets, firstly because China cut interest rates and the reserve requirement ratio, which gave some hopes that China might be taking action to try to boost their economy, and also because the U.S. stock market rebounded last night. So I think all of that helped to support the Asian markets today. However, I think there's still a lot of negatives around China, and this could just be a short-term rebound unless we see convincing steps in coming days by the Chinese government that reassure investors that the government is serious about trying to boost the economic outlook in China. One of the biggest problems that's been around the decline in the stock market in China in recent weeks has been that the economic data has also been worsening. So although the Chinese government did take measures to try to prop up their stock market, there simply weren't enough steps to reassure investors or even convince investors that the economy was about to turn around. I don't think this one rate cut will be enough. I think they'll have to do a lot more. So therefore, I think that this rebound may not last very long unless we really see some more measures by China. Because if you look right now at the global environment, the data coming out of China is very weak for industrial production, for new investment. Also, what we're seeing is global commodities are suffering because expectations are that China is going to be slowing down. So there's a lot of negative news out there that's still weighing on global equity markets. And then, of course, the other question that's in people's minds is, will the Fed raise rates? Because, again, if the Fed raises rates sometime soon, that, again, could put jitters into equity markets in Asia and result in some of the Asian currencies falling against the U.S. dollar.
China's central bank reportedly Thursday set its central rate for the yuan currency at a four-year low against the dollar. Is the devaluation earlier in August, did that catch policymakers in China by surprise, the world reaction to that devaluation?
Well, it seems that they were somewhat taken aback, but I think it was inevitable if they implemented three devaluations in a row day after day that the world would be in shock. So they shouldn't have been too surprised by the reaction. I think what's now very much of concern in Asia is whether there are going to be more devaluations to come. There's quite a lot of speculation and I think even market expectations that this is not the end of the devaluation process. Temporarily, they may not pursue more devaluations, but there is an expectation that there may be more yet to come because China's export sector has lost competitiveness over the last 4 or 5 years, not only because of the currency appreciating against the U.S. dollar and other currencies, but also because their manufacturing wages have been rising. So to try to address those issues at a time when their economy is softening, there's concerns that there may be more devaluations yet to come, either later this year or into 2016, but those are just speculative views right now rather than any concrete indications from the government.
Rajiv Viswas, Chief Economist for IHS Global Insight. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. Well, we turn now to another colleague, G. Abby Lee, for what's being said on social media about the global economic situation, especially what's happening in China. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. Let's start with a tweet by the managing editor of South China Morning Post, George Chen. SCMP is an English language daily in Hong Kong. He tweeted, "I suddenly see Chinese media citing Goldman's suggestion to encourage investors to buy Chinese stocks. Expect 30%+ return by the year's end. Really?" As you know, most of the Chinese media outlets are state-owned, and he's referring to the latest report from Goldman Sachs, a multinational investment bank. Chen's tweet has been shared more than 35 times Thursday. He's on Twitter at George_Chen.
So I see, G. Can you elaborate on the suggestion?
Sure. Goldman Sachs analysts said Chinese shares could rise 36% from current levels by the year's end. That'd be a complete 180 from the status quo because the Chinese markets are crashing.
So why are they expecting it to jump?
Well, mostly because they expect Beijing to intervene. The analysts expect the Chinese government to continue to boost its stimulus. A lot of news outlets quoted the Goldman report Thursday, including Business Insider. If you look at the comment section of the article describing the Goldman report, a lot of people were quite cynical. Let's read one of them as an example. Translation: Goldman Sachs has a major proposition in Chinese equities that it would like to unload on the Muppets. So not a lot of love for the investment bank. That's all for me today.
And many thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee, always here with some good news from social media. A reminder, you can follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA_IE. Still ahead on International Edition, the tragedy facing migrants on the high seas. This is VOA.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Well, as the European Union met in Vienna on Thursday to focus on ways to handle the huge migrant influx, it's overwhelming some countries. Migrant deaths continue to grow as people risk their lives fleeing war and poverty in the Middle East and Africa. International Organization for Migration confirms bodies of migrants have been found in recent days. However, they say, given the situation on the large number of migrants, the discoveries of the bodies were not unusual. Joel Millman is a press officer for the IOM in Geneva. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the migrant tragedies that are occurring even as we speak.
We understand up to 50 were found suffocated in a tractor trailer. I believe the driver abandoned the vehicle, and these are assumed to be a part of a wave of migrants that have crossed very far away, across the Mediterranean into Greece and Italy, and are trying to make their way up into Northern Europe. Well, you know, this kind of thing is not uncommon in Latin America. We've known of deaths like this in Texas and Arizona and Mexico, so it's really not something that should surprise us. Nonetheless, it's shocking because we're talking about a population that's already crossed from very dangerous places across the Sahara Desert or into the Mediterranean, where many have drowned. So to see this happening in Europe is quite shocking.
Also, do you have the latest figure right now on the number of migrants who are crossing into the Western Balkans?
Well, like everyone else, we've heard the figure 3,000 a day, which seems quite plausible given the volume of traffic into Greece, which is where most of these people crossing the Balkans have started out. We are up to now almost 200,000 arrivals in the Greek islands this year, which is a phenomenal increase over the last year. We are talking about 107,000, 110,000 into Italy already this year. The numbers are just really multiples greater than last year, especially with Greece. And we know that the logical destination for someone landing in Greece is one of the Western Balkan states to try to access the EU. Greece doesn't share a border with the EU the way Italy does, so it's a much more difficult transit for the migrants who arrive in the Greek islands. And we understand that there were at least 100 more deaths since, if you include the ones in the trailer today, over what we reported yesterday, which was 2,373 so far this year.
That's Joe Millman, press officer for the International Organization for Migration. He was speaking with Kim Lewis, host of VOA's Africa News Tonight. A man from the U.S. state of Arizona has been charged with supporting the Islamic State militants and helping a New York college student get terror training in Syria. 42-year-old Ahmed Mohammed Al-Ghalmal was indicted for providing material support, as they put it, to the terrorist group. Prosecutors say Ghalmal posted comments on social media supporting the Islamic State, which were then seen by a 24-year-old college student in New York City. Court documents did not provide the name or the current status of the student, and according to the indictment, the student contacted Ghalmal from Syria on May the 7th and said that everything was going according to plan. The deal struck between Iran and six world powers over its nuclear program should see sanctions against the country beginning to ease by next year, and Iranians are hoping that lifting of the travel restrictions could see an influx of international tourists. Henry Ridgewell reporting now from London that travel agencies are already seeing an increase in demand.
With its ancient architecture, breathtaking landscapes, and warm people, tour companies describe Iran as one of the unexplored jewels of the Middle East. But the country's isolation since the 1979 Islamic Revolution has seen visitor numbers from the West fall. The latest figures show only 90,000 arrivals from North America and the European Union in 2013. Former diplomat Mehdi Konsari says there's a lot of work to do.
The difficulties we've had in Iran has definitely hurt the tourist industry in the sense that people are afraid to go. But those people that ventured and, you know, overcame these considerations and visited Iran were never sorry.
Iran's embassy reopened in London this week. The July deal struck by Tehran and six world powers over the country's nuclear program is already helping ease travel restrictions. British travel agency Wild Frontiers has seen a spike in demand, says founder Johnny Bilby.
Two things have happened since the nuclear deal. First of all, the Foreign Office had changed their advice against travel to Iran, and that's made it much simpler for people to get insurance and that sort of thing. So the numbers have gone up again. We've had to put on three extra departures this year alone to cope with the demand for the autumn season to Iran.
British traveller Bugsy Heath Brown has travelled to many corners of the globe. She is looking forward to joining one of the Iran tours later this year, saying it's long been on her wish list.
We decided to get on one of the first trips that we could to get out there, see the sights, meet the people before the big rush of the rest of the world.
Iran says it wants to attract 20 million visitors a year by 2025, generating up to $30 billion in revenue. Again, Mehdad Konsari.
Now that this outside face of Iran is beginning to change, I think the tourism offers a great opportunity for the Iranian economy.
Tour operators say obtaining a visa is still a major hurdle for many visitors, while international sanctions on Iran's banking system mean that most transactions have to be in cash. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
10 years ago tomorrow, one of the most powerful hurricanes of all times hit the southern coast of the United States, with the city of New Orleans, Louisiana, in the middle of its path. That storm left 1,800 people dead and destroyed 100,000 homes. Well, on Thursday, President Obama went to New Orleans to help the people of the city remember Hurricane Katrina's assault on the city and to celebrate the recovery. He said even though the U.S. Gulf Coast has come a long way from the devastation of August the 29th, 2005, it's not yet 100% recovered.
One woman from Gentilly recently wrote me, "A deep part of the whole story is the grief. There's grief then, and there's still some grief in our hearts." Here in New Orleans, a city that embodies a celebration, suddenly seemed devoid of life. A place once defined by color and sound, the second line down the street, the crawfish boils in backyards, the music always in the air, suddenly was dark and silent. And the world watched in horror. We saw those rising waters drown the iconic streets of New Orleans. Families stranded on rooftops, bodies in the streets, children crying, crowded in the Superdome. An American city dark and underwater. And this was something that was supposed to never happen here. Maybe someplace else, but not here, not in America. And we came to realize that what started out as a natural disaster became a man-made disaster, a failure of government to look out for its own citizens. And the storm laid bare a deeper tragedy that had been brewing for decades, because we came to understand that New Orleans, like so many cities across the country, had for too long been plagued by structural inequalities that left too many people, especially poor people, especially people of color, without good jobs or affordable health care or decent housing. Too many kids grew up surrounded by violent crime, cycling through substandard schools where few had a shot to break out of poverty. And so, like a body weakened already, undernourished already, when the storm hit, there was no resources to fall back on. And we acknowledge this loss and this pain, not to dwell on the past, not to wallow in grief. We do it to fortify our commitment and to bolster our hope, to understand what it is that we've learned and how far we've come, because this is a city that slowly, unmistakably, together, is moving forward. Because the project of rebuilding here wasn't just to restore the city as it had been, it was to build a city as it should be. A city where everyone, no matter what they look like, money they got, where they come from, where they're born, has a chance to make it. And I'm here to say that on that larger project of a better, stronger, more just New Orleans, the progress is remarkable. The progress we've made is remarkable.
That is President Obama in New Orleans. Part of that progress made in New Orleans in the past 10 years has been the improvement of the city's levees, which did not prevent the low-elevation city from flooding when Katrina came on shore. Studies have shown that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers failed to build levees strong enough to withstand the surge of stormwater in 2005. But as VOA's Greg Plakas reports from New Orleans, the new levees are much stronger.
10 years after her home was submerged in water, Renata and her family continue to work on repairs.
They're still working on it, but, you know, we got it livable.
Water gushing from broken levees flooded most of this area, known as the Lower Ninth Ward. While many people rebuilt their homes here, there are still many empty lots and ruined structures. After Katrina, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers replaced the levees that failed with better ones.
The new levees around New Orleans are built much deeper and much stronger. But many critics of the Corps of Engineers say these are the kind of levees that should have been built in the first place.
It was the largest engineering failure in history. Katrina was a storm that was not bigger than the levees were designed to withstand.
Martez Lynch and his family live near the new levee in the Lower Ninth Ward.
I feel a little better about the levees today. I mean, the Army Corps engineers and everybody who came out to help can only do so much. Mother Nature will take its course if that's what she wants to do.
But human infrastructure has disrupted nature by reducing wetlands and barrier islands below New Orleans.
One of the things that both the barrier islands as well as our marshes do is they help knock down that storm surge so that when it does hit in some of these communities, it's not as high as it would be otherwise.
Graham says state and federal authorities are working together to restore coastal barriers to help prevent a recurrence of what happened 10 years ago. Greg Flakus, VOA News, New Orleans.
You should check out our website for more on the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. We're at voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
South Korea boasts the largest fuel cell power plant in the world. A 5-acre plant in Hwaseong City, built in just 14 months, provides enough energy to power 135,000 homes. Professor Kim Kyung-nam is with the Green School of Korea University. He says this is a great solution to solve two challenges, energy and environmental protection. 21 fuel cells put out 2.8 million megawatts of electricity each, and coming out of the stacks or chimneys is not smoke, but steam. Vincent Gim is with POSCO Energy.
I think maybe Korea is the only country who is intensively support fuel cell technology.
In 20 years, South Korea plans to provide 11% of its electricity through renewable energy sources while creating new economic opportunities in the future. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us. Now a little something from our music department. Tens of thousands of people gathered in Brooklyn, New York's Commodore Barry Park recently for the Afropunk Festival. International Edition's David Berg spoke with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the two-day art celebration that featured headliners Grace Jones, Lenny Kravitz, and Lauryn Hill.
Oh, this was such an incredible event. So this is the 10th year. It started back in 2005. And it is an extremely important event for a couple of reasons. The primary one being is that it provides a space for people of African descent, African-American people, to exist and freely express themselves kind of outside of the normal labels that generally follow urban expression. So typically when you think about Black youth, you're thinking hip hop, you're thinking R&B, soul music. Well, these young Black folks like punk, they like rock, they like anything that you could, anything out there that they deem to be interesting and quality. So as you say, Grace Jones headlined, well, she headlined the first night, and anyone who knows Grace Jones knows
the incomparable Grace Jones.
The incomparable 67-year-old Grace Jones is liable to do anything. One thing we know she will do is grab a hula hoop and hula hoop her way through a song and a story and introductions of band members for minutes and minutes and minutes, and she absolutely did that. I saw so many videos of her. She was painted in tribal.
Igbo tribal paint.
Paint, yes.
And topless.
And she was, yes, she was topless.
Now, the reason I mention that is because she made a point, because last weekend in New York was also a protest march for going topless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, women are allowed to go topless in New York, as men are.
Right.
But apparently there was this big protest last weekend, and Grace kind of just joined into the whole thing and performed the whole set.
And again, at 67 years old, I mean, I hope that I have half that energy when I get to be her age. Lauryn Hill did a pretty good set as well. Now, Lauryn Hill has been known for being late. I mean, she did not disappoint in that regard, unfortunately.
50 minutes,
yeah,
something
she was
like that?
40, 50 minutes late. She sat down, did an acoustic set, which was kind of cool. Lenny Kravitz, obviously, did a remarkable job. I mean, he is quite the performer. And then in addition to the music, there's art. There's all kinds of cultural expression from sculpture to street art. Of course, fashion plays a huge part of this. So this gives you an opportunity to, again, see people of color in a way that we don't normally see them. And so this was in Brooklyn. They also have a festival in Atlanta. And very exciting, this is the first year that they're taking it to Paris.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know Grace is going to Paris.
Oh, absolutely.
All righty. Well, you know, if you have any questions or comments about this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA _ music. You can also listen for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website. That's www.voanews.com. Listen what I say.
Yeah, you know, it must have been a fun time in Commodore Barry Park in Brooklyn. Whoa. Hey, listen, everyone. Thanks for joining us today on Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. Hope you'll stay tuned. Latest world news straight ahead. You don't want to miss it. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.